With every election that comes by, the topic of voter suppression comes up. You might have heard of stories outside of Illinois that deal with voters in Alabama not being able to vote curbside. You've probably heard of a lot of drama around mail-in ballots. Maybe even something like this.
The president has made mail-in ballots the center of his effort to cast doubt on the integrity of the election.
Are the election results only legitimate if you win?
We have to be very careful with the ballots. The ballots, that's a whole big scam. We want to make sure the election is honest, and I'm not sure that it can be.
More on that in a minute. It is important to understand the case of voter suppression. Every state handles the election differently because of, well, the 10th Amendment. And the fact that there is no federal law on who has the right to vote.
There's no federal law in the Constitution or otherwise that gives the right to vote. There is no federal law or piece of the Constitution that gives people the right to vote. And again, based on the 10th Amendment, which reserves a lot of different powers to the states, running elections is one of those powers.
That is DePaul political science professor Christina Rivers breaking it down why every state has different rules to voting. Because we have 50 states, that means there are 50 different sets of rules. And this inherently makes a system that is bound to have inequalities for voters in the country as a whole. And that is what this podcast is focused on. What does voter suppression look like today, and how has it changed from the past? Taking on this project, I knew that I could define voter suppression to what it looked like in the Jim Crow South. Literacy tests, poll taxes designed to deter poor African Americans from voting is easy and identifiable because of how blatant it is. But those tactics are still alive in today's politics.
Legislators engage in voter suppression by drawing district lines that minimize the voting power of historically suppressed communities, or by passing laws like they did for a while in North Carolina until those are struck down, that would do things like minimize early voting periods or minimize Sunday voting or minimize certain ways that you can go mobilize voters to register to vote, or pass voter ID laws that are very, very, very restrictive that tend to have a disproportionate burden on low-income folks, Black and Latino voters, Native American voters, young voters, where the perception is that young voters are going to be more likely to vote Democrat than not. And so among the 33 or 34 states, I think it is, that have voter ID laws, the most restrictive ones tend to disproportionately impact those groups that I just mentioned. And so many have said that passing state governments that pass voter ID laws are engaging in voter suppression. From what I understand, the data is still not fully out there that shows that there's been a major suppressive impact of those voter ID laws. I have seen evidence that it's significant. Examples of what we're hearing about these days are, for example, Texas. Texas had a limitation on, no, Alabama. This just happened yesterday. It's hard to keep up.
Yeah.
I think it was Alabama where for a while they had the option of what they call drive-up voting, and this is really good for, convenient for disabled folks or older folks or folks who are really, really vulnerable, for example, to COVID, where they don't have to go into the precinct to vote. Somebody comes out and brings them their ballot. And in Alabama, there was a challenge to drive-up voting that was brought by an older, pretty severely disabled man. And it went back and forth and back and forth where there was a challenge to not allow that. And then that was, you know, then he won, then they won. Well, the Supreme Court just upheld the limitation. So, there's this man with Parkinson's disease and I believe it's pretty serious lung issues who is now not allowed to vote outside of his, you know, in his car, where he will, I think the way Alabama election law is set up, he'll have to physically go in to vote. Some people are arguing that another form of voter suppression is really limiting the options for mail-in ballots. In some states like Illinois, In some jurisdictions, it's not even the whole state, there are ballot drop boxes where you can drop them off. Or if you trust the USPS, you can do that. Not every state has these drop boxes. Or in Texas, that's what I was getting back to. Mm-hmm. Texas has passed a law where only you only have one official drop box per county.
Right.
And, you know, the county in which Houston is located, I think has 5 million people in it.
Yeah, Harris County.
Right, as opposed to other counties out in the outlying areas, it may have 200,000 or 300,000. So that has been upheld. And so some people are saying that that is a form of voter suppression for two reasons. If you don't have the physical capacity to get to that drop box, that's a form of voter suppression. Actually, that's the main one. And it typically it's, again, low-income people who tend not to have, you know, to be challenged with respect to access to transportation, and those that also correlates with Black and Latino voters, or people who live in way outlying areas. So it you know, tends to correlate again with low income voters. And so there's this correlation between income level and race where to disadvantage low income, you're not targeting racial groups, so that's not illegal. But it ends up with the same effect.
And mail-in ballot boxes. 50 states means 50 different rules of who can cast their vote this way and when. In Illinois, anyone can request for a mail-in ballot. Right now, because of COVID-19, mail-in ballots are seen as this good alternative to not visit the poll, but still be a part of the election. But in Texas, a person who requests a mail-in ballot needs to be over 65 or have a disability or be ill or incarcerated to receive their ballot in the first place. Traditionally speaking, those few exceptions were mandatory to receive a ballot in the past.
And traditionally that's kind of how they started out. So mail-ins were seen as kind of a backup. And then over time, as states started to expand options for mail-in ballot, what people saw was there was a good chunk of people who started to use them. Because when you think about it, you don't have to take a day off of work or time off of work. You can just fill it out and send it in. And what was becoming apparent was more Democrat voters were starting to use mail, take advantage of that option, and more voters of color were starting to take advantage of that option. Historically, it's been white and Republican voters who have used mail-in ballots, but that's starting to change. And when that started to change is when you started to see some of these limitations. Suddenly, they became a bad thing.
In today's political climate, there has been criticism from Republicans like Donald Trump that question the legitimacy of mail-in ballots. Trump's argument is that they can be forged or destroyed. This is Trump speaking on mail-in ballots on the first presidential debate on September 29th.
A solicited ballot, okay, solicited is okay. You're soliciting, you're asking, they send it back, you send it back. I did that. If you have an unsolicited, they're sending millions of ballots all over the country. There's fraud. They found them in creeks. They found some with the name Trump, just happened to have the name Trump just the other day in a waste paper basket. They're being sent all over the place. They sent two in a Democrat area. They sent out 1,000 ballots. Everybody got two ballots. This is going to be a fraud like you've never seen. The other thing, it's nice on November 3rd, you're watching and you see who won the election. And I think we're going to do well because people are really happy with the job we've done. But you know what? We won't know. We might not know for months because these ballots are going to be all over. Take a look at what happened in Manhattan. Take a look at what happened in New Jersey. Take a look at what happened in Virginia and other places. They're not losing 2%, 1%, which, by the way, is too much. An election could be won or lost with that. They're losing 30 and 40%. It's a fraud and it's a shame.
But not everyone agrees that this threat of an illegitimate election is realistic. And while there can be valid concern over a ballot being tampered with, restrictions need to be reasonable and not suppressive.
Trump has created this boogeyman out of mail-in ballots and again, creating problems, offering absolutely none evidence of how that mail-in ballots are corrupt. You know, he's saying that, you know, millions of mail-in ballots are being stolen and, you know, and he cites these examples of ballots being stolen and trashed and misplaced. I think what he's doing is he's citing these one-off examples. And every once in a while you do hear of an election where, you know, in some jurisdiction, some newspaper article pops up and says, hey, that in XYZ jurisdiction, three boxes, you know, of ballots were found that were never cast, that were never counted, whether they were mail-in or in-person ballots, right? That does happen periodically. Again, no system is perfect, and in those cases, it's not absolutely certain in every single case that this was an attempt to be fraudulent. In some cases, the ballots were just overlooked. In some cases, you just have workers that were not good and didn't care.
What many people are arguing over today is how to decide what is enough verification for the vote to be legitimate and what overcorrection can look like suppression.
When is being careful with someone's ballot too much? To the point where you end up disenfranchising people by making it impossible for them to vote. And that's kind of defined the voter suppression of this particular era. It's no longer back in the days where you had to take a literacy test or, you know, go through craziness to register to vote. It's really become, this is the form it's taken. Voter integrity efforts that cross the line into voter suppression. And, you know, my definition of voter suppression might be somebody else's definition of voter integrity.
Big news came out of Texas earlier this month on keeping that balance between voter integrity and voter suppression. Texas Governor Greg Abbott limited the number of drop-off ballot boxes to one per county, saying it was necessary to beef up voter integrity. This was seen as voter suppression with counties with larger populations, such as Harris County, Texas, where Houston is located. Over 4.7 million people live within Harris County, and before the governor's restrictions were put in place, 12 satellite drop-off stations were accessible within Harris County. After the governor's ruling, the League of United Latin American Citizens, among a few other activist groups, sued the state, calling the shutdown of ballot drop-off boxes voter suppression. Luis Vera, a general counsel of LULAC, explains why he sees it as voter suppression and who it affects.
Yeah, voter suppression. You got counties in Texas, guy, Richard, that are over 100 miles long and 100 miles wide. He ordered that only one box per county, which is in the county seat at the elections office, some people 50, 60, 70 miles away from the voting site where they could drop off their ballot. And two things that are going on, the district federal court recognized this. Not only is the COVID epidemic and pandemic getting people sick and killing people, but it's also the issue of the mail. The U.S. Postmaster cannot guarantee, even if you mailed it, you know, 2 weeks before today, which is a month out from the election, he could not guarantee that your ballot would get there on time. And the closer we get to the election, the worse that becomes. And the Republicans knew this. See, their own statisticians knew after, you know, you always got number crunchers that are in charge. So here, the number crunchers get together and they decided, okay, if we cut out all these locations and leave only one box per ballot, yeah, we're going to discriminate against the disabled, the senior citizens, the ones that are sick. Well, we know that. And we know what's going to affect the Republicans and the Democrats both. But after they do all their number crunching, they realize that, you know, they're going to affect this many Republicans, but look how many more Democrats we're going to affect, so we put it in the force. In other words, those Republicans are dispensable to them. I mean, one of the most conservative groups in the Republican Party, they call it the Lincoln Project, okay? Republican funded, founded by Donald Trump and his group, came out in our favor in both federal court and in the Fifth Circuit, stating you can't do this. You're affecting Republican elderly, Republican disabled, Republican who just can't make it to the drop box, and they're afraid of the COVID, they're afraid of their mail's not going to get there, but they want to vote, and you're disenfranchising them. And Governor Abbott's attitude, well, too bad, too sad, because right, we know we're going to get more Democrats than we are Republicans. I mean, he didn't say that openly, but that's how these decisions are made. They're made by number crunchers who convince them that it's to their advantage to do these kinds of things.
This form of voter suppression is not new to Texas and is endemic to many states across the country. Whether if it's Alabama deciding to disallow curbside voting for the elderly and disabled, or having felons not being able to vote in Florida if they cannot afford to pay their debts, this type of information is hard to show evidence of intentional voter suppression of a certain race or ethnicity. But it does show that not everyone has the same access to the vote. But in the past, rules have been made to protect racial and ethnic minorities, and they have also been taken down recently, with bleak chances of getting them back up.
That provision of the Voting Rights Act, again, which only targeted former Confederate states and a few state parts of states in other parts of the country that had a history of suppressing the voting rights of racial and ethnic minorities, that provision of the Voting Rights Act, loosely referred to as Section 5, was struck down by the Supreme Court in 2013.
In recent years, there has been attempts in Congress by Democrats to push the section to be reinstated or to expand it so that it can enforce the same inspection and have it apply to the entire country. Professor Rivers explains why it hasn't been working so far.
That's one of those don't hold your breath for it, because we would need a Democratic majority in both the House and the Senate, and it would have to be a big one if Trump were to win, because he would certainly veto that, and it probably wouldn't even make it up. Yeah, he would veto it. And so it would have to be a big enough Senate congressional delegation there would have to be enough support in both the House and the Senate to override his veto. So those are high hopes.
Passing in an amendment would be difficult as well, because all 50 states will need to approve that amendment. What is more likely to happen is that states will either adopt policy that works to make the vote more accessible or not. And even then, states are going to take it one by one.